Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to the award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today is the first day of National Catholic Schools Week, so we're going to ring up the Superintendent of Schools for the Diocese of Bridgeport to learn how his schools are working to use a faith-based mission to make a unique difference in the education and the lives of each of their students, as well as the families and communities they serve. Then we're going to drill into Connecticut's somewhat dismal performance in the 16th American Lung Association State of Tobacco Control Report. We're going to talk about how Connecticut residents can play a role in improving the way hundreds of millions of dollars the state collects from tobacco companies and users is spent on actual tobacco education and smoking cessation programs. Then we're going to close with the executive director of Connecticut's Barnum Museum. There's a big new movie out about the life of P.T. Barnum. So how accurate is its portrayal of the greatest showman on earth? Stay tuned to find out all you and the motion picture industry doesn't know about Barnum. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. Griffin Hospital, School of Allied Health Careers in Derby, was one of the first hospital-based schools of its kind to be authorized by the Connecticut Department of Higher Education, and it offers training, education, and certification for phlebotomy, nursing assistants, patient care technician, healthcare careers, and more. The Griffin School of Allied Health Careers is now offering an evening session for its Accelerated Certified Nursing, or CNA, program starting March 12th to help individuals start a fulfilling career in healthcare. The CNA course offers students an affordable and condensed six-week schedule with classes Monday through Thursday from 5 to 9. If you're ready for a career in healthcare or you want to apply to any upcoming courses, just visit griffinhealth.org/allied-health. Well, we're opening our program this morning with a very special guest, a brand new friend of mine and a brand new friend to the award-winning For the People here. We are pleased to welcome Dr. Stephen Cheeseman. He's Superintendent of Schools for the Diocese of Bridgeport. And full disclosure, I spent from kindergarten through my first year of college, grade 13, in faith-based schools as a product of the Connecticut kind of Catholic school system. I guess I did all right, Dr. Cheeseman. So here we are today on Sunday, the 28th of January. Today is the first day of National Catholic Schools Week nationwide. So tell us a little bit about all the folks that you manage over there.
Sure. Well, Catholic schools have been around in this area of Connecticut since the 1850s. The first school starting right in Bridgeport and in Norwalk. There were three: Bridgeport, Norwalk, and Danbury back in the 1850s. Since then, it's been sort of an up and down in terms of growth and contraction as demographics change. But right now, we have over 9,000 students. We have 20 elementary schools on 24 campuses. We have five high schools and a special needs school.
You know, obviously, you have to be living under a rock to not know that there's been a lot of things going on with Catholic churches here in Connecticut and across the country. A lot of retraction, a lot of closed facilities. How many, in your experience, or even if you know, how many schools have been impacted by the closing of their companion churches in the diocese?
Well, in our diocese, we haven't gone through any large-scale contraction of parishes. So that hasn't, up in Hartford they have, and some places in New York they have. But in our diocese, we haven't experienced that. We've had contraction of schools over time, and I would say much lower attendance, now than historically, most of which has to deal with really a changing population. The number of school-age children for us has declined precipitously over the, you know, the past 10 years,
sure.
really. And it's something that the public schools face as well.
That mirrors it. Yeah, that's a great point. Well, let's talk about mission. Obviously, Catholic schools must share a huge crossover or overlay, I should say, to the mission of any public school. But then you add the faith-based component and some of the kind of logistical and administrative underpinnings. But tell us a little bit about that mission and how you feel that's making a difference in both the education, spiritual and social lives of all of your students.
Well, I think put simply, we use three words to define our mission, and that's form, inform, and transform. So our goal is to form the hearts of young people in a value-based, faith-based environment, to inform their minds, to challenge them to be the best that they can be, and really to transform not only their life, but once as their life is sort of transformed in faith and they become, you know, developing and young person, that they actually go out and transform the world. Our idea is to create what Pope Francis refers to as missionary disciples, you know, people who go out and because of what they believe will go out and change the world and help others.
Mm. You pointed out, Pope Francis, an amazing agent for change in the Catholic world. How much has his leadership even in your own personal opinion, how much is his leadership kind of playing a role in the direction that you're trying to set for the Diocese of Bridgeport's Catholic schools?
I think one of the things that the Holy Father reminds us is to accept people where they are and to walk with them in their journey of faith and really to understand their needs, to understand their skills and their gifts, and to, you know, help them grow based on who they are, and not try to fit them into a mold of, you know, what we believe they should be, but really to go out to the periphery to meet the needs of as many people as possible, and to help them grow.
Fantastic. Folks, if you're joining us, we are in day one of National Catholic Schools Week. We're with Dr. Stephen Cheeseman. He is the superintendent of schools for the Diocese of Bridgeport. So, Dr. Cheeseman, not to pit Catholic schools against Jewish schools or Muslim schools or Mormon schools, but to point to what you're seeing as the difference that Catholic education makes, can we speak through the voices of the people, parents or the students themselves who may have come back to you after their departure from the Diocese of Bridgeport Catholic School System and reflecting on the differences that that education has made in their lives?
Yeah, I think when I was a high school principal, I used to say to my students, you know, my focus is not what you become, you know. My focus is who you become. And I think that is something that as students leave us. I used to say it to freshmen and remind them at graduation. And I think as students are going through our system, and much like many other systems, it's not that we own this, but I do think we do it very well, where we focus on who the young person is. You know, by looking at their own skills and gifts and talents, and then try to create in our small nurturing environment personalized learning programs to meet those needs. Our big initiative in the next 2 years here is personalized learning and using technology to help us, to assist the teacher, to meet the needs of every student. And I think when people come back to us, they talk not of a community, but they talk of a family. And I think when you're centered around faith, it makes that family dynamic sort of a unique and special one. Mm-hmm. And I had a parent, one of the most memorable lines was a parent who came to me and said, you know, we came here looking for a school and instead we found a family. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that small, caring and nurturing environment that that we can build around faith and values makes a difference.
Mm. Well, while you look to the future with excitement over developments in technology and the acquisition of that technology to benefit all your students, you certainly have to be looking at the horizon too and the gathering clouds with a little bit of concern as we're starting to hear about the decline in the number of people who are deciding to go into the teaching profession. Can you talk a little bit about how you as a superintendent and maybe the diocese or maybe perhaps even the larger world of Catholic education is beginning to grapple with the prospect of the continuing recruitment of the best possible educators?
Yeah, I think what you point out is true. I work for one college and a university, and I work with both teachers and administrators, and the number of people who are going into those fields is diminishing, and I think it's because there is a tremendous challenge these people are faced who are going into the profession. You know, I think a lot of people look at teachers and say, oh, they have summers off and they have, you know, half a day of work, you know, that kind of thing. They're done at 3 o'clock. And they really aren't. And I think we're not just making a piece of furniture. We're forming young people. And there's a lot of pressure and challenge that you put on yourself in doing that, and a lot of pressure that society and certainly government requirements put on you. So I think there's a tremendous amount of stress in the job and not always a lot of appreciation for teachers, whether public school or private school. And I think that's part of it. Also, with the changing demographics, certainly in the Northeast, there are less students, and therefore you'll have a need for less teachers. But I can tell you, the teachers that we work with are wonderful. We launched a strategic plan back in October, and one of the biggest pieces of academic excellence was really how do we continue to recruit and retain teachers. As someone who was in the public school for a little while, I can tell you that public school people, when they're hiring, love Catholic school teachers because they've been trained well, because they're committed to the development of young people. And unfortunately, because public school salaries are higher, we sometimes lose some of our best teachers. So we're working hard to come up with creative ways to try and continue to retain our best teachers.
Mm-hmm. Another area that it's probably critical to touch upon is the way that the Catholic schools, speaking specifically about the Diocese of Bridgeport, of which you're superintendent, are also grappling with this seemingly exploding class of special needs students, particularly on the autism spectrum. Certainly we hear the hue and cry of all administrators in Connecticut and in our towns and cities and districts of the immense expense that serving these students can put upon taxpayers. Certainly Catholic schools probably face an even greater burden because they are not bearing the benefit of so much public money.
Correct. Yeah, everything that we have to do either is through grant or parental tuition. We don't get state aid in Connecticut that is, in any way real meaningful. So a lot of the burden of that becomes placed on the parent. But we do what we can to provide accommodations and modifications wherever possible. And I think technology has helped make a difference in that. You know, for years, we've always wanted to do and to serve as many young people as possible. And I think now technology sort of helps us. And the idea of creating personalized learning programs means you're not just, it's not a teacher with a class of 25 where you're teaching to that, middle child that doesn't exist, but really challenging every student to grow based on his or her ability.
Very good. Again, another area where your schools do not enjoy a public benefit is in the general funding. You know, in all public school districts, kids just sign up and go to school. In the Catholic schools, there is a tuition factor. Let's talk a little bit about that challenge and the ability for the Diocese of Bridgeport's Catholic schools to still provide some important measure of tuition assistance for those who really need it.
Yeah, we, you know, tuition is a reality in our schools. We do, unfortunately, because we don't have any kind of funding. We do rely on parental tuition, but every student receives every student receives some sort of scholarship, because we don't pass directly on the exact cost of educating a child. So, you know, each student starts off with $1,000 or $2,000 scholarship, depending on the school, based on the actual cost of instruction, and then and that's just part of, we do that because of who we are and trying to encourage people to be part of our schools and to serve as many people as possible. We also offer through Foundations in Education, what's referred to as the Bishop Scholarship Fund. That gives out about $2 million, a little over $2 million a year to students who demonstrate need. And then each school has their own tuition assistance committee. And the tuition assistance committee would look at hardships, would look at, you know, additional aid, that they would try to provide additional scholarships and financial assistance based on the student circumstances. Great. So, you know, we do the best we can to share the resources that we are able to raise through generous donations and people who believe in the work that we do.
Good. Let's bring it right back around to the top then, before we say farewell to you, Dr. Stephen Cheeseman, Superintendent of Schools for the Diocese of Bridgeport. Here we are, day one of National Catholic Schools Week. How are your schools celebrating, and what are some of the activities that you're going to be engaged in over the next week?
Well, first, I would encourage everyone to visit our website, dioceseofbridgeportcatholicschools.com. That gives you a list of all the schools. We'll give you, bring you right to a school's website in your community to take a look at exactly what's going on by you. But each of our schools will have masses. They'll have open houses, other activities to celebrate the work that students do, the commitment of families to bring in parish and community members. And through all these events, the focus is on the value that Catholic education provides to its young people and the school's contribution to the church, the local community, and so on. Every school has an open house with tours going on. And, you know, even if you don't have children that you're looking to place in a school, we encourage you to come learn about the education that we offer and to be involved in not only the school but in the local parish.
Right. As you pointed out, it's not just a community, it's a family, and it welcomes all folks, including those who don't have kids who might be interested in looking for a way that they can support an important entity in their neighborhood or community. Dr. Stephen Cheeseman, Superintendent of Schools of the Diocese of Bridgeport. Dr. Cheeseman, also want to, across the airwaves, credit your assistant, Madeline Pesci, for helping keep things on track this morning.
Keeps track of me and make sure I'm where I'm supposed to be at the right time.
So kudos to Madeline, and thanks to you on this first day of National Catholic Schools Week. Best of luck to you and all your work in the Diocese of Bridgeport. Great to make your acquaintance, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again around this time next year, Dr. Cheeseman, here at day one of Catholic Schools Week. Yeah. Well, our midpoint of the program today brings us back around to the issue of lung cancer and respiratory health. And we're so pleased to have guests on this morning representing the American Lung Association, particularly Ruth Canovi is here. She is the Director of Public Policy for Connecticut for the American Lung Association, which is the leading organization working to save lives by improving lung health and preventing lung disease through research, education, and advocacy. Today, we're going to hear a lot about that research and education because the American Lung Association's 2018 State of Tobacco Control report is showing Connecticut again has earned less than satisfactory grades on its tobacco policies. This 16th annual report grades states and the federal government on policies proven to prevent and reduce tobacco use, and we're going to dig into some of the finer details of that and hopefully empower you as listeners to take that information at the grassroots level and maybe chat up your local or your U.S. Legislative representatives to let them know how you feel about it. Ruth, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here, and this is great.
So, first of all, tell us a little bit of the backstory here. This is the reporting is 16 years strong now with this latest issue, but give us a little bit of the backstory on how this all kind of comes together every year and how it's sort of, it seems quite complex that they're both disseminating mm-hmm. across 50 states as well as the federal government. Probably a lot of overlaying cross points, but also apparently, according to this release, a lot of highly detailed and accurate information that drills way down into the state level.
Yeah, no, great. Thank you very much for covering this. This is an important issue. And so the American Lung Association, like you said, this is our 16th annual State of Tobacco Control report. And so what we've done is, when it started, it was there was some real basic policies that we've identified and have been identified really throughout the scientific community when we look at what helps youth prevent, what helps prevent youth from starting this dangerous addiction and what helps people quit and when they have started to use tobacco, and then what also helps people reduce their exposure to secondhand smoke. So it was originally four areas of policies that were identified, and those areas are just funding for tobacco prevention and control, tobacco taxation, smoke-free air, and access to cessation services. So those are kind of the four areas that the tobacco control community has identified and has really seen results. So when states and the federal government and even municipal entities invest or implement these policies, we see results. We see fewer youth using tobacco products, helping adults quit, and then also just reducing exposure to secondhand smoke. So those have really made a difference, but with so many states being able to implement these on different levels, the American Lung Association wanted to take a comprehensive look and say, really, where are we? Because I think really in 2018, people think that tobacco is an issue of the past. And what we see is that it's still the leading cause of preventable death and disease in our state and our country. Hmm. And there's much more that we could be doing.
Yeah, and based on the way the funding under the Affordable Care Act works as well. A lot of times I am told and have come to understand that a lot of the money that is sometimes being paid into the system is kind of getting spread around and supplementing health care outside our own state. So when we kind of ratchet back up to 10,000 feet or more and look at the entire country, there are implications inherent in this report at the national level that could actually have practical and financial implications to individuals in Connecticut, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I know we'll probably be getting into some more specific details with kind of how Connecticut's looking, but there was something called the Master Settlement Agreement, which states entered into and came to an agreement with the tobacco industry, where the tobacco industry is required to give states money to help offset the costs that tobacco is costing each state, because it really is a grave cost. So, I mean, if we look at the state of Connecticut, Connecticut sees $2.03 billion worth of tobacco-related health costs that we incur. So that's a huge impact to the state's financial health as well as public health. But we also, with I was saying that the Master Settlement Agreement, the industry spends or gives the state of Connecticut over $120 to $125 million a year that is supposed to go towards helping to offset these costs. There was actually a something called the Tobacco and Health Trust Fund that was established in Connecticut that is supposed to be set up to use some of those funds towards helping prevent youth from starting to use tobacco and going through that kind of lifetime of addiction that so many people succumb to. And that's a big issue because we're not seeing that happen right now in Connecticut.
So while we will come back and talk specifically, as you pointed out, about that, because that is where Connecticut gets the big fat F.
Right.
Give me a few of your impressions about the national picture, because, like I said, there's local implications in some ways. In other ways, it can also spur and inspire ideas about how our state might be able to do better by following in the footsteps of what states that may have earned. Well, I guess, have any states earned an A or even a B in terms of how they're turning all of this massive tobacco industry funding for prevention programs into successful outcomes?
Yes, and I believe a few states earn, you know, much better grades than an F, and I can look to see how we do. But I'm looking, and I know that other states definitely do better than we do, and they have seen some success. Great. I mean, looking nationally, I think our report shows that thanks to the success of many of these policies that have been implemented, adult and youth cigarette smoking rates are at historically low levels. So that's excellent. We're really excited to see that. But there's two things that we're also seeing. One is that not everyone in America has benefited equally from this progress. So we're looking at communities like those with low incomes or low education levels, rural communities, the LGBTQ population, and people with behavioral health conditions, and as well as Native Americans, are continuing to experience high rates of tobacco use and secondhand smoke exposure. So while we look at kind of declining rates of things overall, we're seeing pockets of the population that are really being impacted by tobacco use, and then those are often populations that also have poor health outcomes related to this as well. So it's kind of a real issue, and that's why we're trying to draw attention to this and make sure that, you know, people don't think, oh yeah, tobacco, we've dealt with that. Well, we haven't for the general population, and really specifically looking at some populations that have been traditionally targeted by the tobacco industry to ensure that they continue using tobacco products and working there and trying to do better for those populations. And the other thing that we're really concerned about is that we see the adult and youth smoking rates declining. But when we look at actual tobacco use, they're not declining at rates that we're seeing with cigarette smoking. And so we're looking at a huge increase in use of electronic cigarettes. Also other tobacco products like those sweetened grape-flavored cigars and things like that, where we know that those are often youth, and that's a good way for youth to get hooked because they're usually cheaper, they're flavored, and then that kind of leads them into continued use of tobacco and addiction.
So am I hearing you correctly in that generally from a national level, while we're seeing the consumption of tobacco, like cigarettes particularly, declining. The bubble is just sort of kind of hourglass shifting to other products that are not cigarettes, but are still have tobacco and the various hundreds to thousands of, chemicals in them,
right?
That are cancer causing.
Absolutely.
And cause lung disease.
Yes.
All right. Well, this is a good place to break, Ruth. Ruth Canovia is with us. She's the Director of Public Policy for Connecticut for the American Lung Association. Their 16th annual State of Tobacco Control Report was released just a few days ago. And we're going to drill into some of the finer information that has come out in that report regarding the state of Connecticut, including the big fat F in how Connecticut effectively utilizes the $100+ million a year that comes into the state as part of the National Tobacco Industry Agreement of some years ago. Stick with us. We'll be back to talk about Connecticut and the State of Tobacco Report with Ruth Canovia in just a moment. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Connecticut's Healthy Eyes Alliance and our radio stations are helping promote improving and maintaining your sight and the sight of those you love. By supporting the Alliance's campaign to save sight with a gift or donation, you can play a role in providing free vision screenings to almost 27,000 underserved preschool children and 2,600 adults throughout the tri-state area, and distributing more than 500 free vouchers to underserved clients for free eye exams and glasses. If you want to help this organization continue its sight-saving vision, or to learn more about obtaining services, just visit healthyeyesalliance.org. All right. Thanks for sticking with us. Obviously, there's a lot of folks out there who really care about their health and their lung and heart health. And we've got a great guest to talk about that. Ruth Canovia is here with us, Director of Public Policy for Connecticut for the American Lung Association. As you've heard, the 16th annual State of Tobacco Control Report came out earlier this week. And unfortunately, Connecticut has not done well in several categories. I'm looking across the report card here for Connecticut, F, C, B, D, and F. So before we dig into the bad news, let's take the good news, which is kind of interesting in that we get a B for the level of state tobacco taxes. And as you mentioned earlier in the program, Ruth, Connecticut has one of the highest or the highest tobacco taxes in the country. But then that's almost a slap in the face when you look at how much of the money that's taken in, not only through tobacco taxes, but through the federal tobacco industry settlement that actually turns around and goes where it should.
Right, right. And so we get that B in tobacco taxes. Like you mentioned, we have the highest cigarette tax rate. We're tied with New York. But one of the issues here, and the reason we don't get an A for that, because we do know that higher taxes and higher prices often do decrease rates of usage. But there are other tobacco products that aren't taxed at similar rates. So while we can go, if we go to a store and tobacco, a pack of cigarettes is upwards of $10 a pack now, people can buy small, like two packs of grape or, flavored cigars at a much cheaper rate for, under $2 or something. Mm-hmm. So it's much more accessible. So we want to see an equivalent tobacco tax rate for all products. We don't think we should be kind of choosing winners or losers by how people imbibe their tobacco. Mm. But like we said, we also are really concerned about the fact that we talked about the Master Settlement Agreement, but then in addition to that money, we get over $300 million a year related to tobacco taxes. And so we also know that more than 70% of smokers, current smokers, want help quitting or want to quit. So we should be ensuring that there are services available to them to actually help quit. They are paying a significant amount of taxes for their products. So when we see that, recognizing that we have pretty, really high tobacco taxes, but we want to ensure that there's some investment in addressing this really huge toll that tobacco takes on the state of Connecticut's fiscal and public health.
So. Yeah, and based on the fact that the coverage and access to services to quit tobacco receives a D, that's sort of leading us down the path of the bad news. But before
right.
we get into that and the F grades that we received, it just strikes me as odd that when Connecticut is looking at things like possibly somewhere down the road legalizing marijuana for recreational use, raising the gas tax to fund mm-hmm. highway repairs, it's just odd that the state lawmakers have not seemingly discovered and implemented a uniform tax on all tobacco products. Since you are the state director of public policy, do you see an equilibrium on the horizon in that respect?
We've certainly talked extensively with people who are making these decisions, and I think we did make progress this year. There was an increase in some products that's weight-based products. So there's like snus, which is a chewable type of tobacco, and that was increased. One issue is cigars, and so that was proposed in the governor's budget last year. I know an increase on the cap of taxation that exists there. One challenge in Connecticut is that we do export a significant amount of tobacco, and it's a source of agricultural
cash
income.
Crop.
So that's a challenge that we have there. And then are certainly talking about other products that are taxed at a rate of like a percentage of wholesale price.
Yeah.
And then also electronic cigarettes is an area that we could certainly look at as
well. And that's something that needs to catch up on a national level for the most part, I understand.
Yep.
Now, it's interesting that as a cash crop, Connecticut has been known for its tobacco for centuries. So I could see where, strong lobbying combined with the impression on lawmakers' parts that, taking that specific type of action against cigar tobacco and the other types of tobacco that Connecticut contributes to the system would be hurting Connecticut farmers who are already kind of generally suffering, not just here, but across the country. So that does make kind of twisted sense. But we did talk about the failure grade and have a pretty good understanding about the lack of funding for state tobacco prevention programs. But I see we also failed in a category entitled minimum age of sale for tobacco to 21. Is that because of a poor lack of enforcement?
No, actually. So what is going on kind of throughout the country, and this is a grade that was added last year, we're seeing more and more states and municipalities actually change the age where folks can, where they can be sold tobacco from 18 to 21.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just saw in the past year three more states adopt this law. So in Hawaii, California, Oregon, and then New Jersey and Maine, now the age of tobacco sales is 21 instead of 18. And then we're seeing almost 300 municipalities among 19 states also adopting this. So really looking at the fact that 95% of current adult smokers started before the age of 21, and trying to really get a sense of this, the prevention benefits that this could have. There was a big study that was released 3 years ago now that looked at the real benefits that a Tobacco 21 law could have, and so really preventing people from starting to use tobacco products and the great benefit that it could have for folks kind of throughout the country.
Statutorily, do you know if Connecticut permits municipalities to usurp essentially the Connecticut standard, and say the New London or Hartford wants to implement a 21 and over tobacco sales mandate for all businesses. Is that out the window essentially in Connecticut because tobacco is essentially kind of controlled through a Department of Consumer Protection and statutory statewide initiative?
It's our understanding that municipalities actually can implement this rule within their jurisdiction or within their municipalities. We know that there are certain laws like the smoke-free indoor air laws that include preemption, which prevents municipalities from actually moving the ball any further with protecting folks from secondhand smoke indoors.
Yeah.
But when we look at minimum age, it looks like there is some room for municipalities to move. And from conversations that I've had, I know that there are some areas that are looking into doing that.
Excellent. Finally, in the last couple minutes that we have with you, Ruth Canovi, please let's talk about the average. We have a C grade in strength of smoke-free workplace laws. Although, to me, I go in and out of a lot of municipal and public and private businesses, and I virtually don't see any,
right,
except home-based businesses where they still permit smoking unless you're kind of cordoned off into this little a shunning space outside
right,
in the back.
Yeah, and we've certainly done well, but we haven't made any changes to the smoke-free air law since it was implemented. And if we look at our neighbors, most of our neighbors get an A in this area, and there's a number of just exemptions that were kind of included in the law because we were a leader in getting it passed. So since we got it passed, I think there's been a few more areas that have been identified. And when we were leading the charge, it was like, okay, we can make this exemption and make this exemption. But now we're looking at our neighbors and saying, oh, I think we can do better to protect folks from exposure to secondhand smoke. And so there's an exemption where, I mean, any workplace can have a smoking room, and that's not the case for most states that implement this law. And really, the concern there is that there's industry science that says whatever the air filtration systems and those kinds of things don't actually prevent or protect folks from secondhand smoke. And then there's also an exemption that allows workplaces with fewer than 5 employees to be able to have smoking in their buildings. And so we're certainly concerned about that just because of the size of the workplace doesn't mean that people shouldn't be protected from that. And then there's a few others like in behavioral health communities where we're actually seeing higher levels of usage of tobacco products. We're concerned that, they're still allowed. And so we just want to see a better protection of folks from secondhand smoke exposure.
Excellent.
And there's, yeah.
Well, there's a pretty much a comprehensive review of Connecticut's report card on the 16th annual State of Tobacco Control Report, grade F, grade C, grade B, grade D, grade F. Looks like Connecticut needs to do a lot more, and it's going to take folks out there in our communities to make that happen. You can learn more and review this report at lung.org. We're so pleased to be educated this morning through the research of the American Lung Association and its pinpoint here in Connecticut with our Director of Public Policy for the state, Ruth Canovi. Ruth, learned a lot this morning, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again, if not right about this time next year when report number 17 is produced, perhaps maybe in between if we see Connecticut lawmakers taking the these fairly horrible grades seriously. So thank you so much for being part of the program this morning. Well, we never give up the opportunity to visit with what I feel is really one of Connecticut's greatest treasures. Not that you're not, Kathy, but lucky you, you are the executive director of the Barnum Museum down in Bridgeport, which really is a catch place for so much that captures the talent and the imagination and the incredible public service and service to the world of entertainment that P.T. Barnum has delivered since his time. We're pleased to welcome you back. We've got about 10 minutes to talk about a bunch of exciting new things going on. But one of the reasons we wanted to bring you on is because of the kind of the hoopla over this brand new and really extravagant movie musical about P.T. Barnum and yeah. a companion event that you're having later this week.
Yes. This coming Sunday on June 28th. Yes. On January 28th.
Later today, I should say, as we broadcast this on Sunday. Yes, later today.
At 2 o'clock here at the museum. The movie came out officially on December 20th, and we were very fortunate. I was able to see the movie about a week before it launched nationally. Mm-hmm. And 20th Century Fox let us know ahead of time that the movie was not intended to be a documentary, that it was all about capturing the spirit of P.T. Barnum, mm-hmm. you know, the excitement that he brought, the entertainment that was elevated to new heights under his direction.
Couched
so
in
it
some,
was all about that.
I was going to say, couched in some biographic reality and truth, but...
So loosely couched.
Okay, so, well...
And it's fair, you know, in fairness, it's not just Barnum history that... isn't historic. It's American history
that
is really kind of not historic. So there's all kinds of issues that you're not getting in the story in the movie that is actual. So as a for instance, the very beginning of the film, it's very touching. Barnum and his father are in New York City. They depict him as about 10 years old. So in my head, I'm doing the math, that would put the story at 1820 in New York City. So in 1820 in New York City, there are no trains yet at all, let alone trains to Bethel, Connecticut.
Wow.
So they weren't running for the trains. You know, they kind of show Barnum as an only child. Barnum was one of 12.
Wow.
Yeah, so I mean, there are those kinds of things. You know, there's the Brooklyn Bridge being built in the background in one of the scenes. A scene that was probably supposed to be about 1840. The Brooklyn Bridge isn't even started until the late 1860s.
Huh.
And it finished until... So, I mean... There's all kinds of license.
So buffs of history will be apoplectic 10 minutes in.
Yeah, oh, yes. And they already are. I was very fortunate. We were prepared. You know, the Fox folks came to us and we had the conversation. So I was able to sit in the beautiful theater and be prepared to understand it. Now, you can't unwire a historian.
Sure.
You know, so I fully intended to sit there and I'm going to enjoy this movie because it's a movie and it's bringing Barnum back to life. But yet I was sitting there and then you can't not do the math in your head.
Yeah.
But I insisted on not letting that prohibit me from having a great time because that's what Barnum would have wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I did. I enjoy it. Yeah. If you haven't seen it, go see it. Just enjoy it. And then I'm happy to answer all the history questions
for you. We all are
here.
And if it is too late for anyone listening to make it to the Barnum Museum later today for the real R-E-E-L story, which is going to talk in depth about this film, certainly it's wonderful that after the tragedy of the tornado and the massive structural damage that we've talked about at length on our program with you over the years, there is now the ability for folks to, on a fairly regular basis, I guess, come back and visit with you and your docents and others at the museum, right?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And thank you so much for saying that. Yes, we're excited that and hopeful that this will draw more attention to the museum, that we'll find those angel investors that people want to be a part of the re-envisioning of the museum. And yes, we are here for everybody on Thursdays and Fridays. And then if you go to the museum's website, barnum-museum.org, we've got a list of programs because we do have things happening on the weekends, sometimes during weeknights. Mm-hmm. So everybody's welcome.
Very good. Now, in terms like so we're looking at the film that just came out, it's The Greatest Showman.
Yes.
And yeah. Now, how from a factual standpoint, if you were to take that as a total vehicle, I'm figuring you're from a historical perspective, you're grading it C if they're lucky, maybe C minus or worse. How does that compare to the factual reality that's presented in something like the musical Barnum?
Oh, well, you know what? The first time I saw the play itself, that made me pause. Interestingly, because I was there to give a talk back. Mm-hmm. And it was in Bridgeport, and I was like, oh my God, how am I going to fix this? And somebody said, oh, people don't know. And I'm like, of course people know. This is Bridgeport. People know Barnum history. Right. So the play took a lot of license with the Barnum story as awesome. Well, not probably quite as much as the movie. Mm. And again, great music and uplifting. I mean, we are still talking, and not just in Connecticut, there are schools and colleges and theaters all over the United States and even the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. They're rolling out the Barnum play again this year in London. So it resonates with people. The play is still uplifting and it's still fun, and it satifies that requirement that Barnum had for making people happy.
Yep.
So we're still talking about it. And in truth, I mean, Barnum, you know, lived. He was born over 200 years ago. We're pushing 208 years ago. So this is a much older story than people think. You know what he accomplished 2 centuries ago. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. And you look at some of his ideas, which were remarkably progressive. You know, and we just don't even realize some of the methods of promotion and marketing that we use today, and we think we're all so clever, were really rolled out by Barnum.
Yeah,
way back in the mid-19th century.
Foundational to P.T. Barnum.
Yeah.
Well, as your mission espouses Barnum's own ideas about inspiring curiosity, creativity, and competence through instructive entertainment. This is by far not the only activity later today with the real story going on at the Barnum Museum. We did chat for a moment or two before going on, so I know that today was sort of the laying out of the roadmap for activities at the museum for the rest of 2018, and you made sure that I was going to ask you about the Pecha Kucha Nights.
Well done. Yes, I fumble that all the time. Yes, we're meeting next week with the team to lay out these wonderful programs that are called Pecha Kucha Nights, where it's kind of like an open mic in a sense that you're given, you know, anybody can come, sign up, register to be a part of an evening where you have 5 minutes to speak on a subject. We haven't laid out the themes yet. That's what they're going to be doing next week. And you have 5 minutes with no more than 20 slides to do your story. And the audience is there to be a part of it. It's wonderful, innovative kinds of programming that folks like at the Westport Library have done, and we want to create a Barnum one. Yeah. So that's going to be a new launch, a new program series launch that we're doing this year. So we're really excited about that. So watch out for that.
So is this like a poetry slam
it
where
can
there's
be.
There's little Pecha Kucha cults of followers who have already, you know, kind of like when Trivia Nights first started. These little groups of people that were like superstars.
Yeah.
Are you going to get some Pecha Kucha
superstars?
Superstars on board.
Yes, we're hoping so. Actually, we have a couple of our team is a group of people who have planned them because you have to have a certain kind of license for it.
Yeah.
It's not quite like a TED Talk, but it is a thing now. And then one of our team who's done this in New Haven
yes.
is going to be working on it.
Oh, good.
So yeah, so it'll be new for Bridgeport. At least that I know. I apologize to my fellow colleagues if they've done this before, but not that I don't think so.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's fun for that's all ages, but right. it'll be a great time.
Well, we encourage
tweetable moments.
Well, we encourage people to go to barnum-museum.org to keep tabs on all of the developing programs. Consider perhaps on school vacations or on weekends making a plan to visit the Barnum Museum. Perhaps you're a regular commuter or occasional driver through Bridgeport on I-95, and you see this beautiful clay-colored building with the rounded roof, and you wonder, what the heck is that? Well, that is the Barnum Museum. Yeah. It is that close to you from wherever you come on Interstate 95. Just jump right off in downtown Bridgeport. If you could spend 15 minutes or an entire open day there, there is fantastic stuff to learn about, as we're hearing from Kathy Maher, Barnum Museum's executive director. So, Kathy, thank you so much for being part of the program this morning. And we hope that folks who are inclined might also get to know Barnum Museum and consider supporting this institution to bring it back to the place that it once was prior to this massive hit that it took years ago when the tornado hit downtown Bridgeport and almost wiped out the entire museum. It is now back on track, but could use the underwriting to be able to conduct its business and entertain people as Barnum would want for more than just a couple or a few days a week. So, Kathy, thank you so much. Barnum-museum.org is the place to go. We'll see you at the Barnum Museum. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.